Leo and I met with Trump right after he was elected, before he was inaugurated. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have paid more lip service to it than sincerity. You know, I've had two times in my life when you put up or shut up.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're ready. Today, my guest was the former Secretary of California Environmental Protection Agency and the Chief Policy Advisor to the former Governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Ranked number one by The Guardian in its top 50 people who can save the planet, he is also the author of Cracking the Carbon Code, The Keys to Sustainable Profits in a New Economy. And today, he is the CEO of the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Terry Temminck. Terry, thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate you being here with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, Terry, do me a big favor. For those who are not familiar with you and what you do, do you mind giving us a little introduction?
Of course. So my name is Terry Tamminen. I'm the CEO of the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. My background is here in the United States in business. I had some time working in a ranch in real estate. And then in my late 30s, I started to decide I wanted my life to be about something more meaningful. And I got into environmental conservation and protection and started the Santa Monica Baykeeper, which is an organization that has citizens watching for a particular water body, things that are harming it, and then taking action, including suing polluters. And there's now over 300 of these keeper programs all over the world, citizen activist programs protecting different water bodies. And then in 2003, I helped a guy named Arnold Schwarzenegger run for governor in the state of California on an environmental platform. And when he won, which, by the way, I did not expect he would, but he won, he appointed me Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency. And during that our time in office until 2010, we managed to get our Million Solar Roofs Initiative passed, our electric car and hydrogen highway program for hydrogen electric cars launched. We saved millions of acres of wilderness land and marine protected areas for conservation, and our Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, which set up our cap and trade system for carbon pollution. And then, as I mentioned, after we left government, I've worked with the UN and various other organizations around the world on conservation. And then 3 years ago, joined the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation.
There are so many great organizations out there, but why did you decide to join this one?
You know, I've had two times in my life when you put up or shut up. And one of those was when Arnold asked me to come into government after he won the election. And like I said, I, first of all, didn't even expect he'd win, but mostly had no interest in going into government. But, you know, I was promoting a lot of environmental policies in my nonprofit work. And it was time to put up or shut up, go in there in government and actually try to make a change. Well, the second time was when I met Leonardo DiCaprio, and I was trying to advise him on climate change policy. He had been appointed the UN Messenger of Peace for climate change. He had done before the flood, it was still in production at the time I met him, but he had been all over the world looking at the impacts of climate change and turning that into a documentary. And he was very concerned about that, so he wanted to add that to the portfolio of his foundation, in addition to protecting endangered species and their habitats and empowering indigenous voices. And so I was giving him advice about how I suggested he go about it, and it was the same thing. He said to me, well, you should come into the foundation and put all this together, and let's do it together. And again, I had to put up or shut up. It's a moment when you have a chance to work with somebody as passionate and experienced and knowledgeable as he is, and who has such a global following that hopefully we can change hearts and minds and actually use the work of the foundation to make change, but also to get other people to help us do it.
One thing that I didn't realize is that the foundation has been around for over almost 21 years now, and I wasn't aware that's been that long. So tell me, since you've been on board, what has been your main priority? What are you guys are working on the foundation? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're right. It is a little surprising. Leo is only 43. And so to have a foundation that's already 20 years old and has accomplished so much, we've in that time raised and made grants of over $100 million on projects all over the world to save endangered species, tigers in Nepal, elephants in Kenya. The tiny vaquita, which is a little porpoise in the Gulf of Baja, which most people have never even heard of, and a variety of similar issues, of course, trying to protect the habitats of these creatures as well. And then giving support to indigenous organizations and indigenous voices all over the world who are protecting many of these same natural ecosystems, but who also have their own right to their culture and to exist. And so what Leo wanted to do, I think what he realized was that all of the progress that the world is making on many of these things, I mean, we've seen the population worldwide of tigers increase by 25% in the last decade. Now, it was down to about 3,500 tigers in the wild worldwide after originally being about 100,000 the first time there was a census 100 years ago. And so that's a, to then say, okay, well, we've increased it by 25%. It's such a meager population, but still it's showing we're going in the right direction. And when Leo realized that all of that sort of progress could be undone by climate change, that's when he realized we've got to have a climate program at the foundation and tie these things together. And we have to be part of the world's effort to tackle climate change, or we're going to see all of this progress reversed, not to mention the damage it will do to humans. So our climate program works with a lot of different aspects. We help support NGOs that are campaigning, obviously, to get politicians to care about it more. We work with the UN on messaging, but we also do things like we set up a renewable energy fund in Fiji. There's 500 remote islands that are using diesel generators for little microgrids for these villages on these remote islands. And so we put up a fund that the villages can borrow the money to replace their dirty diesel generators with solar and battery powered systems that pay for themselves in about 5 to 6 years instead of paying for diesel fuel. And once they've paid back that system, of course, the energy after that is free and clean. And then we take the money and loan it to the next village and the next one and the next one. And so it's a revolving fund that will continue to perpetuate good outcomes and help people move to a cleaner way of living. So we're very activist as well as supporting NGOs that are campaigning on these issues.
You worked under a Republican governor, and that's interesting because today we don't see a lot of Republicans in office pushing forward environmental policies. Now, do we need the government to be involved moving forward? Is that something that it's a must, or the private sector can do it at all?
Well, we absolutely, it's too late for just to rely on the government or on businesses to deliver us cleaner products electric cars and so forth. Sure, we are all going to have to put an oar in the water and row this boat in a different direction, or we're going to hit the iceberg, if I could use a reference to Titanic, except in this case, the iceberg is melting. So the good thing about someone like Schwarzenegger, and I should just tell you, I'm a Democrat, he's a Republican, but he understood that good ideas don't have a party affiliation. And that, if you go into government, it should be to serve the people. It should be to help your country or your city or your state, not to help your political party. And so he had a great mixture of people, and he showed that that you could all work together to a common goal. And that's why, as I mentioned, we got so much done in our first term in office there, and then have been building on that ever since. Again, Schwarzenegger started it. Public Policy Institute at the University of Southern California to try to work on this kind of post-partisanship idea that if we can get past the partisanship, we can find a lot of things that we agree on. So in the case of climate change, who doesn't like the idea of saving money? So if you are retrofitting, let's say, streetlights in cities with LEDs that save 70% of the energy and pay for that retrofit from the savings of energy and maintenance, who doesn't like that, saving money? And at the same time, you're cutting 70% of the emissions from the energy that's used to power those streetlights. Creates local jobs, it saves money for taxpayers, etc. Who doesn't like the idea of having workers on a rooftop putting in a solar panel? That's a job you can't export to China or India. And because of our Million Solar Roofs initiative, it saved a good bit of our construction industry during the downturn in 2008 and beyond the recession, because instead of people didn't have demand for building or remodeling homes, there was demand for them, to electricians and roofers and so forth, to go put up electric solar panels. So it created local jobs at a time when it was crucially needed. And, oh yeah, by the way, it's reducing climate pollution. So who doesn't like that stuff? And if you just take out the words climate change, you can get a lot done.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, because clearly there's so many attractive things economically, but still there is a good amount of people, at least in this country, that doesn't support it, is not on board. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think there's been a lot of misinformation. I think everyone's aware by now that there's an actual climate denial industry that is funded by fossil fuel owners and managers, the Koch brothers and Exxon. I mean, this has now been well reported and documented that for decades, these companies knew about climate change science and understood it. In fact, there is litigation that we have even supported that is going after oil companies because, much like tobacco companies, they lied to the public and to the regulators about the impacts of their products, even at a time that internally they knew that climate change was causing these problems. And they were actually protecting their refineries and their other resources along the coast from what they knew would be sea level rise and more intense storms. So they were actually investing money and taking steps to protect their own infrastructure at the time they were telling everybody else, oh, don't worry, science is bogus and so on. So you can forgive people for being misled when there was, you know, this multi-billion dollar campaign over many, many years to lie to the public and to pump money into the campaigns of political supporters. Again, it's unfortunate, but mostly Republicans, mostly conservatives. And unfortunately, too many people have followed the money.
We see a lot of large companies these days trying to push this environmental mentality and approach. Do you think they really care? They're really concerned about it? This is something that they want to tackle? Or is just more of a marketing campaign that at the end of the day, it's all about their bottom line?
You know, I've seen both. I'd say that, that for example, the auto industry in America, big three, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, have paid more lip service to it than sincerity. Because, for example, even going back to 2008, when Governor Schwarzenegger was still in office and President Obama, I guess it was 2009 by then when he took office, he federalized what was California's greenhouse gas emission standards from cars, federalized that into a fuel economy program. And there was a ceremony in the Rose Garden with automakers and politicians and Governor Schwarzenegger and everyone saying, okay, look, we can do this. We're going to have these cars that are getting this great increase in fuel economy, which will then reduce emissions of all kinds, greenhouse gases and other pollution. And everyone shook hands and said, okay, we can do this. And then immediately the car companies went back to their lobbyists and started lobbying to prevent the regulations from going into effect. And of course, now, since Trump's been in office, they've been doing that. Surprisingly, though, they are not as aggressive about it as Trump is. They want some further flexibility, but they realize that consumers want clean cars, they want electric cars, that this is a trend that's shifting, and just to meet the demands of their consumers, they're going to have to follow. So I'd say it's a little bit of both. There's times when it's purely lip service, and then at times when it's more sincere. But I think that example of the car companies demonstrates that the sincerity comes when businesses think it's in their business interest and their consumers want these products and this change. So that's where we all come in. We have to provide that demand and get them to change.
Let's talk about the current administration. In your opinion, are they doing anything right? Is there any proposal or policy that you think could be beneficial to the environmental cause?
Honestly, no. I wish I could say yes. In fact, Leo and I met with Trump right after he was elected, before he was inaugurated. We spent time in Trump Tower with him, went through a whole long list of things that he could do as president that go along the lines I was mentioning before, things that were good for the economy that would also be good for the environment, like energy efficiency programs and waste reduction and renewables here in the U.S., all things that would be good for the economy, so he could brag about that. He'd never have to say the word environment or climate change, but of course, we would all know that those are things that were equally good for the environment. And he seemed to embrace it and then, of course, got in office and seems to have just gone out of his way to do things that are harmful, whether that's trying to roll back protections for for conservation lands, like the Bears Ears National Monument, trying to shrink that, and various other national monuments and protected areas, whether it's opening up more areas for oil drilling in some places, even where the oil companies aren't interested in going there because the price of oil right now just doesn't support it, whether it's, like I mentioned, the car companies where he's wanting to roll back all of the fuel economy standards. And even the car companies are saying, well, look, wait a minute, we don't want to get stuck in a court fight with California and then a disadvantage with other car companies that are delivering more fuel efficient cars to the United States, and we're going to lose out. So even they're not asking for this. So I'd say, you know, as much as I try to find a silver lining, there just isn't one. And I'd say the other thing in terms of this administration and the environment, and actually many topics, is it's just stunning the incompetence of the people that Trump has surrounded himself with. Pruitt certainly knew when he became EPA secretary or administrator, he certainly knew how to regulate the U.S. EPA, but he was so corrupt that everything he did got challenged in court. He tried to circumvent the regular rulemaking process. And so absolutely nothing that he tried to accomplish got done, and he ultimately was hounded out of office in corruption scandals. And so, you know, it just, and the first Interior Secretary was hounded out for the same reasons. And I mean, you just look at the people Trump surrounded himself with, and they're just incompetent. So unfortunately, much as I would like to find one thing to hang my hat on and hope that there was some future in this, I'd say, unfortunately, the answer is no.
I want to ask you about the green economy opportunities, because you have advised several companies when it comes to green investments. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
All right. So I know there's great potential there, and a lot of people look into all those opportunities. So for those, for better or for worse, those that want to make money and of course, help benefit the environment, what are some of the industries or trends that you see that perhaps people should start investing or putting more time and effort to develop those new technologies?
Well, I think there's a lot of areas. Again, I would point to anything that deals with energy efficiency, whether it's controls that help us, you know, make sure we turn off the lights when we're not in the room, or more programmable thermostats and other kinds of things. Even something as simple as double pane and triple pane windows and other insulation products. These are all things that pay for themselves from energy savings, create local jobs, but it's also the quickest way to deal with climate emissions, because if we go to work building a new large scale, utility scale solar power plant in the desert, it's going to take years to get it permitted and many more years to get it constructed and bring it online. That's good. We need to do that. But if you change, as I mentioned before, let's say all the light bulbs in your streetlights from the old ones to new LEDs, you have a savings literally overnight, both in emissions and in energy cost. So I think energy efficiency is really where all of us as a society need to put a lot more attention. The second area I'd say is waste reduction. That's another one that can get some much more immediate benefits. We're not very good at recycling in this country. Even in Europe, we're only at about 35% to 40% of what could be recycled is actually captured, and the rest ends up in landfills or in developing countries, very often just in open dumps. And the organic material and some of the other material just decomposes into greenhouse gases and causes pollution and so on. And then, of course, we go out and we cut down more forests to get more pulp and paper and wood, or we go dig up more landscapes to get minerals or oil. And we do it all over again, when in fact these resources are coming through our hands and just going into the dumps every day. And so if we want to reduce deforestation, which is contributing to climate change, if we want to have new industries making something out of literally a waste, all of the recycling industries and the things that are converting recycled material into new products are really exciting. And there's more and more of those every day. And then I'd say the third big area certainly is in things like renewable energy. There's companies that are making solar panels much more efficient, or the way they deliver energy more efficient. Wind, smaller scale wind that can even be put on a home or on a building. Battery technology, of course, as we know, renewables are intermittent, so you have to store the energy somehow if you want to use it at night. So there's new technologies with that. Hydrogen, really exciting. You know, it takes a long time to charge your batteries in a battery car, but hydrogen fuel cell cars are also electric cars, same electric motor under the hood. But instead of carrying heavy batteries that take hours to recharge, you just refill your tank with hydrogen, and it's converted by the fuel cell into electricity, and it only takes 5 minutes to refuel. So it's very familiar refueling. And so I actually think the future of electric cars will be in hydrogen. So anybody wants to get involved in the future of electric cars, that would be a very good place to focus.
That's fascinating. I wasn't aware of that. But one thing, too, I think I'm interested is that all of those you just mentioned is things that perhaps require a lot of capital. But for those who, the entrepreneurs of the world, or perhaps the small business, the one that really drive the economy, how can they tap in on those opportunities? Do you see anything, or we're still a little bit, a few years before those become a little bit easier to develop it?
No, not at all. I think just about anybody can get involved in these things. I mean, it just depends on what your business is, of course, but I think a little bit of Googling around on these issues I mentioned and just doing a little bit of homework, educating yourself about these technologies, you're going to find things that work. I mean, for example, you may not be in a business to help install more hydrogen fueling stations for hydrogen fuel cell cars, but you might have a business with a warehouse where you have forklifts. Well, one of the biggest uses today of hydrogen fuel cell technology is for forklifts. So when it comes time for you to replace your forklifts, and if you want clean ones instead of gasoline or even compressed natural gas ones, you might investigate that. If you are in the construction business, as I mentioned, you might want to think about branching out into home installations of energy efficiency retrofits. That's a huge booming business now where people are realizing that, hey, I can get modern windows and thermostats and air conditioners and just have a much better quality of life by doing these retrofits that pay for themselves from the energy savings and improve the value of my home. So it's a big booming business now. And people are also more concerned about indoor air quality. We're realizing that there's a lot of off-gassing from, you know, carpets and cleaning supplies and other things in the home. And so people want cleaner, more healthy homes. And so there's a big opportunity there if you're in any of the businesses that service the building industry or the home remodeling industry. Certainly anything to do with efficiency, if you're in the web-based businesses, with any kind of web-based business, there's a lot of platforms that help people connect to these products, green products and services. If you're in retail, there's a lot of things that reduce VOCs or other pollutants and help people live a greener lifestyle. And that's just everywhere now. I mean, even 5 years ago, you didn't see much about that in advertising. And today you do. I mean, people are very aware of what's in the supply chain of their food and the products that they're wearing and that they're using and bringing into their home. So, you know, it's hard to give a broad answer without knowing a particular industry or small business that someone might be in. But I think if you educate yourself about these issues, which you should do anyway as a voter and as a consumer, that you're going to find things your business can be part of.
California has displayed a lot of leadership in anything related to environmental policies. Can you give me more examples of other countries or states or even private companies who are really pushing forward environmental policies and raising the bar?
Well, I'd say a couple of things in terms of governments. You're absolutely right. California, certainly with our Global Warming Solutions Act, which several states have adopted and our leading energy program, we now have a law that requires California to get all of its energy from renewables by 2045. And we're well on the path to that. We're over a third right now. And we're 40% more energy efficient than the rest of the country because of our California Energy Commission and the work we've done to make our buildings and homes more energy efficient. But Denmark is 40% more energy efficient than California, and they've got a pretty good lifestyle too. So we can look to countries like Denmark. As I mentioned, Fiji now has this great renewable energy program that we set up for their remote island villages. So even if you're rural or you live in a remote place, you can be thinking about being part of the green economy. And in terms of companies, I'd point to Walmart. You know, Walmart made the commitment to get to 100% renewable energy and zero waste by 2025, I think is their timeline. So in the very near future. And they've made tremendous progress on that. And most people don't even know it. And they certainly don't experience anything different when they go shopping. So so they're really a terrific leader, because not only do they show you that you can make money in the retail world by being sustainable, but they also are pushing their supply chain, which is, of course, huge, to do the same things. So I'd say take a look at Walmart.
Part of your job is tackling an issue that's so big that we impact everybody, that will not only define our generation, will define generations to come. Do you feel that pressure on your shoulders? I'm very curious to know how you deal with that. How do you deal with stress, anxiety? How do you cope with the responsibilities of your job?
You know, I don't believe in stress. I honestly don't. I first of all, when I'm faced with a really tough problem or emergency, I always ask myself, what's the worst that can happen? And usually it's something that you know that even if it's the worst that happens, it's something you can deal with. It's something, you know, you're prepared for. And, you know, sure, there's life-threatening circumstances that you certainly want to respond to more vigorously, but that's rare. Most everyday stress is stuff that when you really ask yourself that question, you go, oh, all right, well, the worst probably isn't going to happen. And even if it does, I could handle that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, I try to exercise every day. I try to swim, or if I'm traveling, I'll take long walks and learn maybe the city that I'm in, or walk between meetings. And that gives me time to just think about things and organize myself and stay organized. And usually, you know, it doesn't matter how stressful life is. If you feel you're organized and you kind of know when you're going to get things done, it relieves the stress, and you just find, you know, life is beautiful.
Besides everything that's going on, are you hopeful about the future?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, when people ask me, when will it be too late to address climate change? I say that, look, it already is too late for the people who lost their homes and their lives during Hurricane Katrina in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. And that storm was definitely exacerbated by climate change. It's too late for the people in Bangladesh, a year or so ago when we had the terrible, devastating storm in Houston. And tragically, I think it was 38 people died there in your community. At the same time, 1,200 people died in Bangladesh. 40 million were displaced because of similar super storms and flooding. And that didn't get a whole lot of attention. There's no FEMA over there. There's, you know, nobody was holding rock concerts. There's very little, you know, Red Cross or other aid for those people. So the truth is that it's too late for many people already. But I'm hopeful that now that more people are becoming aware, the technologies are getting better, that even with someone like Trump in the White House, that the world is still moving in a better direction. And at least in our country, we have states like California, cities, including Houston, that are taking action and will make the world more sustainable. So I'm hopeful for many of us. I'm saddened by the losses that could have been prevented if we'd acted sooner.
I always ask my guests to recommend a book. Do you have one in mind?
My publisher would probably shoot me if I didn't mention my own book, Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, which lays out how oil companies acted like tobacco companies and lied to regulators and the public and what the harms have been. And it's dramatic. But even though that's an ominous title, it has a happy ending because I lay out there the path to an electric transportation future, which includes a good bit about hydrogen, as I was mentioning earlier. So that's a good one I would certainly recommend. I'd say there's a book that came out a few years ago by Bobby Kennedy Jr. called The River Keepers, and it's still in print. And it's really a great story about how people can take control of their own environment and not leave it up to government. And as I was mentioning before, I started the Santa Monica Baykeeper, and Bobby and John Cronin, the Hudson River Keeper, were the ones who started the whole movement. And now there's over 300 keeper programs all over the world. And it shows that people can take responsibility for their river, their coastline, their bay, their lake, and protect it and use tools available, campaign to get people to understand what's at stake and make change. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Are you writing a new book anytime soon?
Well, I just finished one that's completely unrelated to my day job. It's The Lost Letters of William Shakespeare. I once upon a time was hoping I might be an actor. I studied theater in college and had a few little flirtations with being an actor. I ended up being drawn into other things, as I mentioned, but have always had a lifelong hobby of being in theater and studying Shakespeare. And I came across letters which, after 25 years of research, I believe were written by William Shakespeare and have never before been published. And they tell a fascinating story of his early life. So if anybody's interested in learning more about William Shakespeare and the one thing that's related in that book to what's happening now is it's amazing in Elizabethan England to see how many of the same problems they faced as we're facing today. They had devastated their forests at that point, cutting them down for fuel, and were living with some of the consequences of that. They had tremendous pollution from air and water. They were afraid of foreigners that were coming in, taking their jobs. There was national debts from foreign wars that many people didn't think were necessary. There were religious conflicts. It's all very similar to today. So in a way, if by reading about how people dealt with those things in the past, maybe we can be more hopeful about the present. So anyway, The Lost Letters of William Shakespeare, just now out and available on Amazon and iTunes and all that, both as an audio book, ebook, and a print version.
Gotta check it out. Is writing something that comes easy to you, or you had to work for it? It's something that you need to sit down and really put the time.
Well, you really do have to, but I take the approach that, look, get it on a piece of paper because you can always edit it later. You can always refine it, go back and fix it later. I don't understand this concept of writer's block that some people have. You just get started, and even if it's a draft you throw away or have to edit, you at least have the flow, you get the information out. But it's a skill and something that you get better at over time. I wouldn't say my earlier writing was as good as I hope I am today.
Before we let you go, tell us how we can get involved with the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, if we want to volunteer or donate, and also how and where we can follow you on social media.
Well, I'd say, first of all, go to the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation website. It's leonardodicaprio.org. And there's lots of things there. There's action items. You might want to, if you haven't downloaded the film or seen Before the Flood, that's Leo's documentary about climate change, which is well worth watching. And go to the website. There's an action hub at beforetheflood.com and .org that gives people things that they can do in their everyday life and of course, campaigning. And my own Twitter and other social media, Facebook and so forth, is just at Terry Tamminen. So if you can spell my name right, you'll find me.
That's right. Terry, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate you coming on board and tell us a little bit more about the foundation and your work. And thank you for being on the front line and really driving this very important conversation forward.
Well, thanks for your podcast and for helping get the message out. And I'll leave you with this thought from William Shakespeare. He said that nature's bequest gives nothing, but doth lend. And so when nature calls thee to be gone, what acceptable legacy canst thou leave? And I think the legacy you're leaving by drawing attention to these issues and helping people find solutions and find hope is a legacy that even William Shakespeare would be writing plays and poems about. So thanks so much for inviting me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Terry Tamminen. Thanks, Terry.
So long.
Hey everyone, make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.